brain. It's much tough to use your brain.
In half shelters.
What time of year?
What time? In late fall.
Cool. We'll just wait a minute for the courtroom to clear. All right, Ms. Knight. The next case is Anders versus Waste Management.
Good morning, Presiding Judge Woods, Judge Bauer, Judge Sykes. I am Tricia Knight from Knight & Associates, and it is my pleasure to represent Steve Anders, the appellant in this matter. Stephen Anders is asking this court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to Waste Management on his FMLA, ADA, Title VII, and Section 1981 claims. There are two types of cases, or two types of claims here in this case. There are the interference with substantive rights, and there are discrimination claims. The discrimination claims would fall under the two different direct and indirect burdens of proof. But we are asking this court to rule that that type of burden-shifting method is inappropriate under the interference with substantive right claims. In particular, what we are asking the court to find is that under the FMLA and ADA, the crucial issues are twofold. First, that an employee must first show they are entitled to the substantive rights. And if they can then show that they are entitled to the substantive rights, then the issue becomes whether or not there was interference or lack of respect for that employee's rights.
Now, before you get into the merits too deeply, if we could address the threshold issue of the Rule 56, Local Rule 56 filing.
Sure.
That you made that the district court disregarded because it was not in the proper form and essentially used some very harsh language that it was impossible to follow, et cetera. And so he completely disregarded it. And if we uphold that ruling as not an abuse of his discretion, can you still prevail on any of your claims in this appeal?
I would say yes. I would say the first issue would be whether or not under Nabosny the entire record is open for review. In the judge's decision, as you correctly pointed out, he did exclude the plaintiff's facts, but he scoured the record and decided also on alternative grounds for Waste Management. I think probably the most important aspect to that is the fact that there were several depositions cites to Dennis Dreifel, who Waste Management alleges was the decision maker in this matter, that would kind of bolster or support his claims that he was making.
But I'm not sure what you're saying in response to Judge Sykes' question, because what Judge Stadmuller said was, as she says in rather pointed language, I can't follow you, so I'm going to accept, as the local rules provide, Waste Management's account of the facts. That brings in a lot of things. It brings in a history of violence. It brings in reasons for letting him go that would not seem to be pretextual at all if there is nothing else on the other side. And he has said, as the rule permits him to say, unless he's abusing his discretion, he's taking Waste Management's facts. Now, you seem to be now saying, well, he isn't really taking Waste Management's facts, but I think he tells us that he is.
I agree with you that he took Waste Management's facts, but in his statement and summary of facts, the district court actually cited not to a proposed finding of fact by the defendant, but to, on multiple occasions, to Dennis Dreyfel's deposition testimony, which was not raised in one of defendant's proposed finding of fact.
This so type you think of, that just so opens the whole record back up again?
This type of situation arose in Nabosny, and this court cautioned the district court that in circumstances where they are going to exclude the plaintiff's facts, they must stay within the narrow confines of defendant's proposed finding of facts and the specific grounds that they are moving for summary judgment. If a district court goes outside of those bounds, then the entire record is open. They have a duty, in essence, if they're going to scour the record for one side, to scour the record for the other.
I don't see how the district court went outside the bounds of the defendant's proposed fact-finding.
In his statement of facts, there was probably about seven, eight cites to the deposition alone that bolstered Dennis Dreyfel's or the proposed finding of facts based upon testimony that Dennis Dreyfel made in deposition but was not cited or raised by the defendant as part of their factual offerings.
So there were not citations to those portions of the depositions in the proposed findings?
Right, by the defendant. In addition, there were several grounds on all of the cases in which he ruled on kind of alternative grounds. For example, under the ADA, Waste Management was arguing that Anders could not prove that he was a qualified individual with a disability because he had testified that after he got diagnosed and treated, he ended up fine and went on to be a truck driver elsewhere and did his, I think he said, his job 110%.
Well, you would agree, would you not, just to pause on that for a moment, that under the ADA, the fact that you have an illness for a day or two or even a week doesn't make you a person with a disability for ADA purposes. The Supreme Court has set a rather high bar for a finding of disability. It's clearly defined not to be a temporary matter in the statute.
I agree with you, Your Honor. The record here, though, is not a temporary passing condition. It's panic anxiety disorder and depression. It had been going on for years. In fact, there was a point several years earlier where Anders had been taken by ambulance to the hospital from work because they thought he was having a heart attack. The problem that
the problem is he'd been working all this time. I mean, if it's got to be something that substantially impairs one of your major life activities before it's a disability, and the record's perfectly clear. I can't imagine how a rational trier of fact could find that Mr. Anders was unable to work, even if working is one of those major life activities as opposed to walking and breathing and, you know, the other things the statute mentions.
He has not alleged, for purposes of the FMLA claim, he has alleged that the medical condition, when it did flare up in November, was rendering him unable to do his job. In fact, on November 6th, he told Snow, his supervisor, in that meeting that he was having such complications that there were times he was having to pull over to the side of the road because he couldn't drive, and oftentimes he would have to sit there for a 30 to 60 minute period because he just was incapable of driving. He has not alleged for purposes of the ADA that he was substantially limited for a long period of time in the major life activity of working. What he has alleged is that he had multiple flare-ups over time, and it was the multiple flare-ups when he was in a flare-up, a panic attack, that the disabling condition occurred. And this court has recognized that it is oftentimes the flare-up that is the disabling aspect.
Not in ADA cases we have, and I really don't think. Maybe in Social Security disability cases there's sometimes. But there's a real difference in the standard. Anyway, you're in your rebuttal time. You're certainly free to take it if you want.
But I will go ahead and
if
stop.
If you'd rather wait, that's fine, too.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Merkinich.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for having me. The trial court in this matter correctly applied its own local rules and the law of this circuit to grant summary judgment in this employment case, dismissing the various claims alleged by Stephen Anders against Waste Management at the close of discovery. Anders worked as a unionized waste hauler in Milwaukee until his termination. He was terminated because he engaged in physically aggressive actions toward his supervisor. Actions that took place after verbal threats and after he had been granted a leave and nevertheless driven 30 miles to initiate the confrontation. At the hospital that day, intake documents confirm him as having assaultive ideation aimed at his supervisor. This is not about medical conditions. It's not about medical health. It's about behavior in the workplace.
What about this procedural question we were exploring? Ms. Knight says that the district court did wander outside the confines of your submission, and once that's done, then the whole thing is fair game.
Your Honor, we believe that's an erroneous reading of both the record and the law. The trial court is allowed to conduct its own courtroom. I don't believe it's disputed that there's a complete failure to comply with Local Rule 56.2. The way briefing works, the defendant is the moving party in summary judgment, submits its materials. The plaintiff responds. The defendant submits again. At the time that we're doing that, we don't know how the trial court will rule on all the Rule 56-related procedural aspects of the case. So I can't tell you that there's one page in the Dreyfel deposition that the court referred to that wasn't identified in the first submission. But I will tell you that what the trial court said was absolutely within his discretion and absolutely within his control and absolutely in keeping with both the spirit and the context of the local rule. Because the failure of the plaintiff to comply with the rule prevented the defendant from submitting additional proposed findings in the right form, because you can't comply when the other side doesn't play by the same rules that the court has imposed. So I think, first, the trial court correctly described what it did. And secondly, even if the trial court cited to one page or two that aren't within the pages cited within the accepted findings, that's also within the trial court's discretion given the context in which the ruling occurs. And this court, on repeated occasions, in fact, it's hard to figure out which case to cite for the proposition that this circuit regularly enforces local rules because they recognize the burden on trial courts to face. Just look at the size of the appendix in this matter. That burden of that amount of material, a trial court cannot function without a disciplined approach to interpreting a record. And that's all both parties are entitled to. It's what the trial court's entitled to. It's what a reviewing court is entitled to. And there's no basis to believe or assert that the trial court is not true to its own ruling or that the trial court abused its discretion in the way it made that ruling or applied that ruling. So we believe that is in and of itself dispositive, and the findings as submitted make clear that this was the reasonable application of accepted behavioral standards in the workplace, a pre-existing policy preventing workplace violence, in addition to common sense that says you cannot have employees who intend to initiate physical confrontations with their supervisors, especially after having been warned. So we believe that that alone is dispositive, and that could be and should be the end of it. On the merits of the discrimination and FMLA claims, that just reinforces the conclusions reached by the trial court. If you look at the nature of the claims, the race discrimination claim, there is no comparable person who engaged in assaultive behavior of the same sort and was not let go. Mr. Anders does not really dispute that he was having at least a bad day, but it was more than a bad day. When he reported to work that day, he became upset because he did not have the route that he wished he had. So he said, I'm out of here. I need a leave. Interestingly, there's no denying. He was granted the time off when he asked for it. And what did he do? He told someone at the site, I'm going to go to the site where my supervisor is, and I'm going to take him out, and then I'm going to come back and take out my immediate supervisor. What did he do? He drove 30 miles to initiate the confrontation, arriving before Mr. Dreyfel, before Mr. Snow, who was one level above Mr. Anders' own supervisor, Mr. Cook. And when he got there, he did exactly what he said. Now, did he have some medical issues? Perhaps. He was clearly in a distressed state. But a distressed state does not excuse assaultive behavior. That, the workplace, I mean, this court in the Palmer case recognized the dilemma employers face. On the one hand, you do want to accommodate people with problems. On the other hand, you can't bring violence into the workplace and let employees behave that way toward the employer itself. So what did Mr. Anders do? And this was a consistent account from everyone who watched it, the only exception being Mr. Anders. And what did he do? He lurched toward Mr. Snow. He lunged in his direction. When he clenched his fists, and Mr. Anders is a large person, Mr. Snow was personally afraid for his well-being. Mr. Schiller, a coworker, non-supervisory, who submitted a report that Mr. Dreyfel considered, intervened physically to restrain Mr. Anders from lunging at Mr. Snow and making contact. Mr. Anders then did go to a hospital, and the medical intake notes make clear he had assaultive ideation aimed at his supervisor and workplace. So not only was it perceived at the time by all the people there as an assault, but it was confirmed by the people Mr. Anders went to see afterwards that that's in fact what happened. Mr. Dreyfel considered that evidence, and he decided that it was time for Mr. Anders to be terminated. Mr. Anders' own union did not challenge that termination decision, effectively conceding that just cause existed for termination.
Well, didn't Mr. Dreyfel also have evidence of at least a few prior incidents?
Mr. Dreyfel had before him evidence of prior confrontations, including one within the prior month, where Mr. Anders again became frustrated and became potentially violent and angry and directed that personally at his supervisor.
Is there indication that he had been warned or otherwise alerted to the need to stop that?
Yes, he at that time had been warned by his supervisor that that was not acceptable behavior. Plus, in the company policy documents, it specifically warns all employees that that is not acceptable behavior. So you have common sense, a specific policy, and a specific incident before the events that led to Mr. Anders' termination. And when you look at the comparables, there are no comparables. This circuit has been very clear that you need similarity of conduct, similarity of supervisor, no showing of those things. On the disability claim, the Palmer case involving the courthouse employee is very clear. This is not about direct threat. This is about qualifications. Mr. Anders was not a qualified employee, and there's no pretext here, because, in fact, there was a legitimate reason to terminate him based on his own behavior. Whether he ultimately ends up with medical treatment is not relevant to how he behaved in the workplace. On the FMLA claim, the employer must have notice. The employer had no notice. At the time of the discussion on November 6th that was referred to, Mr. Anders had not seen a doctor. He was not under a doctor's care. He had a process through the union contract by which he could request a leave. He did not pursue that leave. Interestingly,
so isn't this one of those places where this initial Rule 56.2 process is important? Because to read his brief, he claims that he specifically asked for family leave, but I take it that was not...
That's not part of the Rule 56 request, nor, Your Honor, would we submit that a Rule 56 request does not excuse bad conduct. So it's irrelevant to the termination claims and the other claims. And he was not denied leave when he did actually request it. Mm-hmm. And we would submit he was not, on the merits of it, entitled to it because he was not treating with a physician, nor had he given the employer sufficient information to believe that he had not missed 3 days of work, he'd not treated with anybody to believe he needed it. There was a process in place that he didn't follow, and it was in the union contract, so it was clearly known in the workplace. So for a number of reasons, we think that's also an invalid claim. The final claim is for retaliation. And the retaliation claim likewise fails. Mr. Anders, after leaving Waste Management's employ, went to work for another waste hauling business. And Waste Management acquired that waste hauling business, and in determining which employees to recruit and retain, made a decision for the same reasons that Mr. Anders had been fired, that he did not meet the qualifications needed to work for Waste Management, so he was not one of the employees selected to transition for Waste Management. That was because of his behavior and a specific history as an employee of Waste Management, not because of anything about the existence of a lawsuit. And we note that there is at no point, either in the facts as alleged and accepted by the trial court properly interpreting its rules, any suggestion of direct discrimination by anyone in this case. This is a case in search of a theory and in search of facts. Having found neither, we simply get arguments that are twisted and unable to be presented in the format that the local district court rules require. And applying well-established Seventh Circuit rules and deferring to the trial court's own interpretation of the local rules that govern the summary judgment process, this court, we ask, we affirm the judgment of the trial court and affirm the dismissal of this case on the merits and with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Knight.
With regard to the scope of the record question, I just briefly would like to direct the court to page 21 of our initial brief. Nabosny versus Pedlesny. The circuit court cautioned district courts that if they are inclined to venture outside the moving party's grounds for summary judgment or statement of undisputed facts, the court must be careful to ensure that the record reveals no issue of material fact. It also says, if the court does so, the movement is entitled to rely on the entire record on appeal. That was briefed, and there was absolutely no response by Waste Management on this issue. So I direct you, I point out that that's where most of our argument is with regard to that. One important thing here is there are disputes of fact. On November 18th, Bill Snow admitted he over-exaggerated the violence thing. That was in the union grievance meeting. It's a very important direct statement, direct evidence admission as to what he reasonably believed at the time. The medical records.
That's about the November 12th incident, though, right? Not the earlier incidents.
The earlier incidents, and I'll jump down to them. I have them here. There was no prior warning at all. There are two during discovery. Nothing popped up on prior incidents other than October 24th, which was a statement written after the fact, after November 12th. There was no mention of the other two. Steve Anders knows of one where he was called a racist comment by a coworker. He told the coworker to knock it off. The medical records are also in dispute. The one in a whole sea of about five doctors that saw Anders, one doctor, which we have not even been able to locate, says what they are supporting. The rest say that is not true. Travis Kajawa is a comparator. Dennis Dreifel was on the decision team in 2001 when he engaged in violent and threatening behavior, actually engaged, it was undisputed, and he was suspended for 3 days. That was part of Dennis Dreifel and some other management individuals' decisions. With regard to interference with the substantive rights issues, he has provided notice on FMLA. On November 6th, he provided notice, and it was obvious, patently obvious on the 12th. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.